You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast. From the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence.
We would like to thank Casper and ZipRecruiter for the continued support of Spycast. You'll hear more about these great companies later, but first, let's meet our guests.
We're joined today by Jack Barsky, whose life has been improbable, impossible, and downright fascinating. This true spy story had a very humble beginning in the most backward corner of the old East Germany. Smarts and hard work got Jack out into the world, where he started a career teaching chemistry and math at a well-known university. And then his life took a fantastic detour. Jack was recruited by the KGB and infiltrated in the United States, where he spent 10 years actively spying for the Soviet Union. He resigned from the KGB, if that's something you can actually do, and embarked on a very successful career in information management. When he was finally discovered by the FBI 9 years after his resignation, his life took a yet another sharp turn. Today, Jack is a law-abiding, patriotic American citizen who's taking advantage of one last chance to live a normal life. He is the longest surviving known member of the KGB illegals program that operated during the Cold War, and is the author of Deep Undercover: My Secret Life and Tangled Allegiances as a KGB Spy in America. Welcome, Jack. Thank you for talking to us here at Spycast.
Glad to be here.
So I want to begin talking about luck, because luck, and sometimes good, sometimes bad, plays a pretty significant role in your story, and actually starting out where you were born. I mean, a lot of times you think about being born a certain place can shape your life. If you're born in the developing world, you have less resources than others. If you're born in certain countries, you're behind the Iron Curtain, or you're in, you know, the United States. How did being born in East Germany shape your life moving forward, in the most basic sense? Obviously, that's your whole biography, but you're talking more about things like making you who you were today, your personality.
In my presentation, I often start out with something like this, that life, the trajectory of your life is pretty much determined by the intersection of when and where you were born. In my case, that's absolutely true, because I am pretty much the product of World War II. You know, if World War II didn't happen, my parents wouldn't have met, because they were fleeing the Russians coming and were trying to get to the West, and they wound up in the same space. So that's how I came into being. And then I wound up in the Russian occupied part of Germany, which made me a communist, which then, you know, eventually resulted in me as becoming a spy for the KGB.
Some of the hardships of East Germany also had some influence on your life. It certainly made you self-sufficient. And would you say it made you a true believer at that point? Did you buy fully in to the idea of communism when you were young?
101%, because that's all we ever heard. And, you know, in some households, when the doors were closed, your parents or uncles, grandparents would say something different. And in our house, there was silence. There was politics and philosophy, religion. None of that was talked about at home. And everywhere else, it was communist ideology. I was absolutely a believer, even more so as I got older and I had an interest in science and math. We were actually told that, you know, the communist ideology had a scientific foundation. Marxism, Leninism was considered a science. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the way we were taught history, you know, it starts with the Stone Age, and then we get to slavery, which was a certain formation in society, which was replaced by feudalism, which was replaced by capitalism, right, which was going to be replaced, right, without a doubt by communism. And I was going to be an active participant in accelerating that process and make the world a happy place.
Well, and particularly coming out of World War II, where, you know, a lot of Americans don't like to admit this, but the Soviets do the heavy lifting in defeating Hitler.
Yes, they did.
And, you know, and so all the propaganda, or if you want to use that word, all the ideas coming out of East Germany at the time was that the communists were the ones that defeat Hitler, that defeat fascism.
Well, it started out, first of all, that the communists also were fighting, were the only political force before Hitler took over that were fighting the Nazis in the streets. Mm-hmm. Now, the outcome wouldn't have been that much better if they had won, but the bottom line is they lost. And a lot of communists, if they didn't manage to flee or go underground, were killed. And, you know, the most prominent of them was Ernst Thälmann, the leader of the Communist Party, who was murdered by the Nazis about 6 months prior to the end of the war. And so now juxtapose this with the fact that the United States took over the Gehlen Organization. It was military intelligence for the Nazis.
Right.
I mean, to me, that was a really, really big mistake, historic mistake. The intelligence that Gehlen was able to provide them with regard to the Soviet army and military was probably not a good counterweight to the damage that was done ideologically. The ammunition that we had on the East was, yeah, you see.
Right.
You know, we are fighting these evil forces that are the successor to the Nazi regime. And you know, at one point, the first American name that I remember is Eisenhower. And it was a cartoon, and Eisenhower was depicted as an evil man, and that's what I knew growing up, that the Americans were evil, Eisenhower was evil, and whatever. And was so I was going to fight that nonsense.
Right. So the name Jack Barsky is one now you've had for the longest period in your life, but it's not the name you were born with, and it's not the only name you've ever had. What name were you born with?
I was born with the first name of Albrecht. That is, I was named after the famous middle-aged painter Albrecht Dürer, and the last name was Dietrich. Very difficult to pronounce for Americans.
Yeah, I read it, and I was like, Albrecht Dietrich.
Yeah,
now it's the best I could do.
The and R sounds are difficult.
Do you still identify with that name or any other name, or is it?
Well, when I'm in Germany and somebody says Albrecht, I will turn. If I hear it here, I probably won't, but that never happens, really. I'm more Jack. I have carried this name longer than the other one. But the Germans, my old friends can't help themselves, and, and they also use my nickname, which I never like, but I won't disclose what that is.
Your life leading up to when you were recruited to be a spy, you write in the book, really prepared you for being a spy. We talk about being self-sufficient growing up in East Germany with rationing and other things. But you were also and are also very smart. You were studying to be a professor. And it's you say in the book that this intelligence combined with self-sufficiency made you confident, made you feel invulnerable. A lot of the perfect psychological makeup for being a spy. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, sure. The entire enterprise of going undercover is a suicide mission. Nobody in their right mind should think that they can do that. But I was so full of myself, and I got nothing but third-party confirmation how great I was, that I thought, I can do it. Mm-hmm. I can even pretend to be an American. It was a challenge. I've always been very competitive. And when this opportunity came up, and the question was raised, can you do it? Do you think you can do it? Yes. Yeah, I got to try it.
You didn't know what you didn't know at the time, how difficult it was going to be.
No, of course you didn't know. And but, you know, again, ultimate belief in self and confidence that anything that comes my way, I'll be able to handle, because I had a track record of success. Once I started kicking in school, I beat the crap out of the competition, mm-hmm, every time in a big way. I worked hard also. It wasn't just like intellect, you know. Right. I wasn't necessarily the smartest, but I outworked everybody. And so what I did not have was a mentor, a father figure, somebody who sits you down and says, you know what, you're full of shit, I'm sorry. You know, there's this, he's not doing right, and this, and you just stop. You're not the smartest person in the room. There's always somebody smarter than you. And oh, by the way, maybe there's a God out there who created all this stuff. None of that happened to me, right? None of that happened to me. So I was sort of in my own bubble, believing in self. That's dangerous for a young person. It's very dangerous.
I want to talk about your recruitment, which began in 1970 as you're starting your fourth year in college. We can work through that a little bit, because I think our audience would be very interested to know how the KGB played recruiting you. Because it was interesting. It's somewhat slow play. They took their time
very much so
to recruit you. And what was interesting in the book was that you were kind of given small tests to see if you had what it took. They didn't commit to you right away.
No, they didn't. This was a mutual feeling out. Well, what they had in mind for me from the get-go was to do undercover work. And first you need to find out, is that person qualified? Can they do it? Are they trustworthy? Can you believe them? Are they reliable? And are they ideologically sound? All of this required, at least that's what they thought, required them to work with me unofficially for almost about a year and a half. Interestingly enough, what they never did, they never gave me a psychology test, a personality test. Even today I'm scratching my head why that wasn't done. But there was one individual who worked with me for this year and a half while I was still studying, and then an employee of the university, who I bet you wrote every time we met, wrote a report, right? And, you know, we became really friendly. I told him about being shy around girls. And I still remember, he said, "You just think, remember one thing," he would say, "they like guys." So he was sort of, he was older than me, but he was close enough to relate to this, you know, that age. And then he did give me tasks such as investigating in an undercover kind of fashion. Like, go find, there's a person who lives at a certain address, this is their name, and they have somebody, a relative in the West. Talk to them and find out a little more about that relative. And so I would go there, and I remember one time I would go there and introduce myself as by a different name, first name, and I would tell them that I was doing some kind of a study for the university, and can I ask you some questions? And I would rattle down questions that had nothing to do with the object of the investigation, but eventually find a way to lead into that and allow the person to just spill the beans without them knowing what I was after. So I never used that technique in reality, but that was one of the things. I also had to investigate objects, and when I took that trip to down south all the way to Bulgaria, I was asked to write reports about, you know, my impression. I also was asked to profile some fellow students. I don't believe that this was meant to, you know, to report on them and see whether they're good, bad, or indifferent. The Stasi did enough of that. I think it was more like practice.
Yeah, I thought what was interesting is they didn't give you a lot of guidance to do this. It was more of just go do it and figure it out
and
on
it
your
was,
own.
It was a lot of ad hoc, quite clearly. There was no sense of a sort of a curriculum, even loosely structured. Well, you got to do this, you got to do some of that, and a lot of it was ad hoc.
Do you think that was on purpose? Like they were trying to test you, or they just didn't really have a system in place for developing new agents?
Well, when you think about Mitrokhin, who brought my name over out of the KGB archives, he wrote in his in the Mitrokhin archives that there were six of us that were being prepared. So that wasn't a factory. So you can think that maybe the ad hoc was because of the rarity of that kind of an operation. So I'm guessing it's just because it was somewhat unusual.
As they prepared you to start your bigger training to work in the West, this was something, when you undertook it, you had to leave everything behind. You had to almost essentially disappear as a person.
I did.
At this point. And you can imagine the tradecraft is just kind of learning, but the psychology of this had to be something entirely different. Just to up and just say, I'm no longer this person.
Yes. Well, there was I was prepared to do this because there were two steps ahead of time when I sort of said goodbye to the world as I knew it. The hardest part for me initially was to leave Jena, the town where I studied. That had become my home. I was somebody there. I was already respected, and I was going to have a career. I loved playing basketball, and you know, my basketball team was sort of the family that I didn't have when I grew up. And I had to leave all of that and wound up in Berlin all by myself. At that point, I already went undercover in some sense. I still had my name, but I already couldn't tell anybody where I was working. I didn't go to a job every morning. I was on my own. And so there's already a sense of loneliness and separation from the world. And then I did 2 years in Moscow, which was even more lonely, and it was miserable at times. So then going to the United States, the only thing that changed was a different name, and I spoke a different language.
Right.
But that loneliness, it was almost a relief that I could be in a world where I could go to the movies, understand what they were doing, and then eventually start interacting with people again, other than just the handlers from the KGB.
Right. You did a training mission to West Berlin, and this is really to get your feet wet, to see if you can handle things psychologically.
Yeah.
What was your first impression of the West? I mean, this is really the first time you had seen.
I still tell the people today, and folks who were in East and West Berlin in those days, agree with me 100%. It felt like East Germany was a movie shot in black and white, and in the West they had color. It's like it was day and night. Just the facades of the building and the way that people were dressed, it was all more colorful. Not that this made a dent in my ideology, but that was the very first impression. And then I noticed the cops everywhere. and they had light blue uniforms. They weren't as visible as the East Germans, who were dark, like bright green. But I saw every one of them.
And none of them were paying attention to you, but I imagine you probably thought every one of them was.
It was a scary experience, and there's an episode, I think that's in the book. If it's not, it's interesting, because I once ran into a classmate from high school in Berlin, and he spilled the beans. He said, you know what, I was being trained by the Stasi, East German intelligence. I was trained by the Stasi, and I was supposed to go to West Germany undercover. And then he said, I couldn't do it. When they sent me to West Berlin, I was so afraid I had to come right back. So it was an important test.
Right.
Because, we were so prepared to know that you are in enemy territory that for a lot of people, they just couldn't handle it psychologically. Well, I got through it.
Yeah.
And then they sent me one more time, and the second time I actually had to do an investigation. So I did this knock on the door and talk to somebody, and that worked too. So that was an important step also for them to understand that, he can do it.
Well, you talk in the book about really needing two sets of skills when you're doing undercover work. One is the tradecraft, the old technical skills.
Right.
And then there's the soft skills, like the ability to adapt to situations, to blend in, to handle things psychologically, those kind of things. It seems that you excelled at that. Was that, when did you gain the confidence that you could do that part?
Well, there's a funny thing. The tradecraft, I got feedback from the folks who taught me, and I was told that I was one of the best at everything that they threw at me. That includes encryption, decryption, Morse code, secret writing, surveillance detections, all of this. I was always getting high praise. Mm-hmm. The personality thing, I never really knew. Maybe they, I know now that I, I display, when I'm not tired, a certain charm, and I can, you know, people like me for the most part. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
They may have sort of thought about it, and maybe they felt it, but they never reinforced that with me. So, and then as I went to the United States, I sort of manufactured an introverted personality. So I really didn't know how people relate to me, and it took a long time to figure this one out.
Right. I think a lot of people might be wondering, anyone who's taken a language before in their lives, and, you know, I took Spanish my entire life. I'm from Miami originally. You had to.
Yep.
And I took Russian in school.
Oh,
and
boy. That's
not easy.
Killer.
But I got pretty good at accents. Like, I minimized my accent as much as I possibly could, but people will listen and realize you don't have a German accent. And you certainly would have had one in the beginning. I wonder about the English training. You talk a lot about in the book about it. And what's interesting to me, and I think anyone who gets fluent in a language will understand this, it's not just about learning English, not just about learning words. It's the accent, of course, but it's like nuance in the language. It's slang. It's stuff that...
Oh, yeah.
And you talk in the book about needing to learn how to think and feel like an American.
Right. I mean... You just ask about four questions in one,
oh, I know.
In one sentence. So and we can talk about this for another half hour at least. Let me just go to the accent. I personally can still hear it, and there's some people who can and some can't. It's not obvious, but it's not pure American.
You sound like you're from Jersey to me. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I've been told. Now that I'm in Atlanta, you sound like a New Yorker.
Yeah.
Oh, surprise, surprise. Yeah. I lived there for many, many years. But learning English is actually quite hard. There's a lot of people in this world who speak English, but to get to a point of near perfection, that's hard because the English language is diffuse. It's not very precise. Oh. You know, you look up the words get or do or can in the dictionary, and there's three pages of it.
Right.
And the other thing is the way I learned it, it was book knowledge, so I acquired a vocabulary that was way too big. And you don't know, unless you live with folks who speak the language, you don't know which is the appropriate word to use.
Right.
And even years into my stay in the United States, I would occasionally use a word that everybody said, "What do you mean by that?" Well, I read it in the New York Times some time back, and I learned it.
Yeah.
So it even from that point of view, it was an almost impossible task. I got lucky in a way that when my first exposure to a group of people was as part of the messenger group for the company I work for. So that's those people really didn't care who you were, where you came from, where you're going. But I was able to observe a lot and listen, and so by osmosis, after a couple of years, I was a whole lot better than when I first started.
Well, you had some pretty famous or infamous tutors before you came to the United States. Can you talk a little bit about names maybe some of our listeners have heard of?
Well, the infamous couple were Lana and Morris Cohen, the atomic spies, arguably more effective than the Rosenbergs, who were executed for what they did or possibly even didn't do, because there's some question to what extent what's Rosenberg's the woman, what's her name?
Mm-hmm.
Ethel, what she did. But anyway, Morris recruited some folks who... I believe some physicists who brought out secrets, and Lana did this famous run where she smuggled out stuff that Mr. Hall gave her.
Yep, Ted Hall.
Ted Hall, and she talks about it. There was an interview with I don't know who, I think it was PBS, and it's they managed to get out before they were caught. I think they would have faced the death penalty as well. And then they eventually wound up in, after a stint in Poland, they were sent back to England and did some more spying over there, wound up in jail, and then were exchanged. Mm-hmm. So, I worked with them, and they were the nicest people. that were wonderful and believers in the communist cause until their dying days. Naive, childlike naivete. Mm. There was this one. I'll never forget it. Morris, who aged prematurely. You know, 8 years in jail will do a number on you. And he had a certain cadence to his talk. I can still hear it. But he came all excited. He had learned a little Russian, and so he would read the front page of the Pravda, and he said, he called me Bruno. That was my name. He says, Bruno, see this? Bread will be free in 1980. Well, that wasn't so exciting for me because when I was there, which was in 77, bread was like 10 kopecks or whatever. Yeah. And it cost next to nothing. But to him, that was a great step towards communist nirvana. And they were so isolated. And they didn't speak Russian very well. They had a really nice apartment and lived in one of the most upscale areas of Moscow. They had no clue what was going on.
Right.
No clue.
So your first North American trip was actually to Canada.
Yep.
What was the purpose of this trip? There's a lot of interesting anecdotes from this, but you describe it, or someone describes it to you, as Canada's like the United States, just less people and colder.
Yeah, that's true. That was as close to the United States you could get without being there, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, just lived there for a while, listened to the language. I mean, they picked Montreal for some reason as the city of entry. I wouldn't have picked it. I would have picked Toronto, right? But there may have been reasons that they didn't share with me. I had some tasks also. But 3 months I spent in Canada, and I should have not ever gotten out because I think it was the FBI or at least the Royal Mounted Police was on my tail. I think the FBI eventually, they were following me. They got to a point where they actually found the first hotel in Montreal where I stayed, and they interviewed the innkeepers there. And FBI showed me during my debriefing a sketch of me that was done based on their description. Somehow I got out. I wonder why that was possible, because they knew my name. Maybe they were just a little too late and I had already left the country.
You tell an interesting anecdote about and something that to me really kind of stood out as far as little basic nuances in culture. You'd never seen a twist-off cap before.
Yes, right.
And that to me is like you're sending somebody overseas. You want to know. Those little things is what can trip you up.
You bet. Yeah. So at my first dinner, I get a bottle of beer and I ask the waiter for a bottle opener. And he looked at me like, okay, are you kidding me? And I had no idea what that look meant. And I said, I just want to open the bottle. And then he showed me, well, you just do this. Here I was traveling with a West German passport. They had these twist-off caps in West Germany. And East Germany, we didn't have them. There were a few other things. One of them, if I may jump ahead, because that's, quote-unquote, the funniest one.
Yeah.
So when that's in New York. So in Moscow, a pack of cigarettes, the most expensive cigarettes, was 40 cents. So that was really cheap. And some others you could get for 20 cents. Bread and cigarettes were cheap. And so it was not unusual that if you were, say, standing at a bus stop, that for a stranger to ask you for a cigarette, it would just come up. And you give them one or two, and no problem. So I'm in New York maybe for a week. I'm walking down Fifth Avenue past Bryant Park, which I know now and found out sometime after, was a hangout for small drug dealers. And so I'm walking down there. Some fellow approaches me, and he whispers, smoke, smoke, smoke. And I hand him I had a pack of Kent, and I hand him a couple of cigarettes. And he looked at me, are you jiving me? He didn't say it, but he looked at me like really weird. I had no idea what that look meant.
Yeah.
Later I found out why. He was trying to sell me marijuana. Right.
This is those cultural nuances, I guess. How could you possibly know? I mean, that's not something that's in the KGB manual.
No, you can't. Yeah. And so there's this... this notion out there in the public with some people that the Russians actually built an entire city, a model of a city, to train people how to be Americans. Well, if that existed, they never let me in.
Well, and even if they had, you know, there's no information about these little things that just make Americans American.
That's right. And even the resident agents who came back from the United States, you know, those employees of the embassy or even United Nations, they didn't know. They didn't know. So I liken this to, say, somebody who was into fish. And those guys were looking at life in America as if you look from the outside of an aquarium and you watch the fish, and then they were trying to teach me how to be a fish.
Right.
Well, that doesn't work.
Right.
Because they never really, those folks never integrated with American society. They were outsiders.
Right. Know?
They interacted with Americans, but you don't learn how to live one like that.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about execution mode. Can you tell me a little bit about that? I think that might be interesting to the listeners about, you know,
yeah,
how you go.
It has nothing to do with killing.
No, right. Yeah, yes. We'll talk about the Americans a little bit later, but one thing that certainly separates you from Philip Jennings is that you didn't go killing everybody you saw.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixth Sense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. Visit sixthsense.com to learn why enterprises choose them.
How do you go about getting yourself psychologically amped up for doing something as dangerous as you are? I mean, for most Americans, thinking operating in Moscow undercover under a fake name would be something incredibly dangerous for an American agent. How do you get yourself in that right mindset?
There's a psychological numbness that sort of overcame me, and I pretty much disabled my brain. You know, normally, you know, there's always something going on here. But those moments, the only thing I allowed in there were the thoughts, what needs to happen next. So there was no, you know, thinking about the past or the wife that I had just left or anything like that. It was just like narrowly focused on the task at hand. You got to get through this, and you do this, and this. And when I was through those particular moments, such as, you know, entering the United States or crossing borders here and there, or even the time when I thought I left my girlfriend, who then became my wife for the last time, you know, at that point, you know, I didn't allow myself to think anymore because I had a focus on the task that was to be done, and only that.
Did this come innately, or is it something you learn somewhere?
No. There was nobody ever told me this. This is sort of like how I approached it.
Yeah. Well, it came in handy in May 1978. Your life changed forever. Moscow decided to send you to the United States. And this is when you got your name. So who was Jack Barsky?
He was a young boy, and actually, I have a picture of this young man. He was a very good-looking young boy. He died from, a very vicious strand of tuberculosis at the age of almost 11. And there's a graveyard not too far from here where his gravestone still is, and that's where a resident agent found that information, photographed it, sent it back, and it was decided that somebody should try to get that boy's birth certificate, and somehow that agent was able to obtain a birth certificate posing as this boy's father.
Mm. Have you ever visited the gravesite?
I have not. I've seen a picture. No.
What was interesting to me was it wasn't just about getting a name. The KGB essentially developed an entire backstory because you were appearing as an adult in the United States.
Yep.
You needed a history. I mean, we talked today about how difficult social media makes doing these kind of things because everybody's got a Facebook profile and everything else.
Yep, yep.
But you still need to actually have a life before this. Were you involved in that, or did the KGB just hand you over a dossier?
No, I got some materials that in this case, it was somebody from New York. A person went around and took pictures of places where I grew up, elementary school, middle school, high school. Also found a place where I worked for a while, sort of bringing into play the fact that I knew some chemistry. So there was a chemical factory that was conveniently destroyed. So I still remember the name of the George Luters and Company. So I got all that material, and based on that and the facts that were on the birth certificate, we started concocting some stuff. And what I wrote about 6 pages worth of things that I quote unquote remember about my life. And a lot of that I carried over from Germany, but for instance, friends. Teachers, I changed the names to make them English-sounding names. But at least if somebody were to ask me, your first teacher, what did she look like? I would describe the German person.
It can't be a complete lie. It's got to be based in some reality.
You have to hang it on to something. So it was 6 pages worth of data. It also had me disappear. I dropped out of high school because I didn't have a high school diploma, and then my mother died, and I was all depressed, and I disappeared from the world, and I worked on a farm for so many years. That also helped when it came to applying for a Social Security card, because farm workers were at that point still not subject to the Social Security Administration. So it was. It took quite a while to put this all together, and there were like fundamentally at least 3 people who worked at it. The fellow who took the pictures and got the initial information, the fellow that I worked with, and myself. But most of it was really my idea.
Let me ask you about documents, since you brought that up. I want to ask you once about what I thought was a very funny story about when you arrived in Chicago, and you were William Dyson at that point, and it was a lot more difficult than you thought it would be to eliminate William Dyson, especially no one had really taught you how to get rid of a passport before.
These things, I was told, they take a lot of effort to make. I once invalidated a passport by taking, I was always supposed to take Aeroflot flying into Moscow, and one time I took Alitalia, and I got hammered for that. And my handler says, "Don't you ever do that again. These things, we can't use that passport again, that name, because it's now on record as having flown into Moscow. And these are very hard to do." So I guess they didn't have enough of these passports for me to practice how to destroy one. They were flame retardant. When I tried to burn it, it was an acrid smell that filled the bathroom there. So that doesn't work. The picture wouldn't burn either. So I eventually And I had a pair of scissors. I started cutting them into small pieces and flushing them down the toilet. And then I had some deodorizer for the room that I sprayed around. But there was still a residual smell. Yeah. But that place, you know, it smelled anyway. So it was one heck of a dump I picked for my first night.
Documents are really the key to establishing your credibility and your cover. There was a plan for getting to documents, and the holy grail at the end of it is a U.S. passport.
That's right.
But you had to work your way up to that. Can you talk a little bit about that process? It could take 2 hours to talk about that, but in a kind of version.
That was actually a rather specific plan. It was very, you know, it was very detailed in its planning and how I should execute on it. The passport was the crown jewel, but to get to a passport, you need to do some things ahead of time. The first thing would be a driver's license, but in order to get a driver's license in those days, you needed to have a birth certificate and then some other ID. Mm-hmm. And in that list of some other ID was a library card. So that was supposed to be easy. You just go to the library and say, yeah, I want a library card. Right. And guess what? And it wasn't easy because they wanted proof of address. You know, I lived at a hotel. Well, I couldn't give the hotel as an address because that's not really, or they wanted to see an electric bill or something that proved that I lived in that area. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to get over that hurdle. I eventually got a membership in the Museum of Natural History that had my name and I could put the address on it. And that was accepted by a librarian in Brooklyn. So from then on, it went easy.
Right.
The driver's license was a piece of cake.
Yeah, you prepared like crazy for the driver's license, and it was just, here you go.
That was a piece of cake. The Social Security card was one of the more scary moments because I had to go in for an interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I obviously anticipated the question, so how come you don't have a card? So, you know, I dumbed myself down to a point where I rubbed soap into my eyes to make me look red and didn't shave. And, you know, I tried to look like somebody who just fell off a potato truck. And I responded to questions with one or two words, which apparently was very convincing. So maybe I should have taken up acting when I was younger. And so that went, in execution, it went very smoothly. So now I needed to get a job, and I finally got a job. And after a year of working on that job, we were going to go for the passport.
That's where big major hiccup.
Big hiccup, and that was a mistake, a planning mistake that, in hindsight, we should have known better. I practiced filling out the application in Moscow. They had one and said, "Well, this is what you write," and I followed that to a T. There's two flags that alerted the agent who looked at the application. A, I didn't, because it was not necessary to fill out. I didn't fill out where I was going to go and when I was going to go,
right,
leave the country. And secondly, I wrote a profession, bicycle messenger. Well, I should have written independent contractor or something like that and should have said Jamaica in July.
Right.
That would have been okay. You know, he saw that, and apparently they probably had a checklist of some sort. And he said that. He said, Mr. Barsky, we have some doubts about your ID. Could you please fill out a secondary questionnaire? So I take the questionnaire back to the back, and I confidently figure out, name, address, no problem. High school graduation. What high school did you go to? At that point, I knew the gig was up.
Right.
I couldn't possibly write down the school that was in my legend because I didn't graduate from that school.
And that would be easy enough for them to check.
You bet. And so I managed to grab my application and my documentation and run away. So I didn't run, but I stormed out, like angry. I said, I'm going to use the S word again. Mm-hmm. Make sure that my wife doesn't listen to this. So I went up to the window and I said to the agent, I don't need this shit. I mean, just pretended to be annoyed.
Yeah.
And then I was worried that somebody might follow me, but nobody did.
Well, at a certain point, you couldn't be a bike messenger forever. And you had a, not only did you have a chemistry degree, but you were a professor of chemistry back in Germany, but that didn't count in the United States because you couldn't tell anybody that you had a degree. So you had to get an American degree, and it wasn't like you're going to get into NYU or Columbia with as a you know, farmhand. So you went to City College because they allowed you to go with essentially a GED at that point.
Right.
So you start as a freshman at City College, which is a great school, but 8 years earlier you were a professor of chemistry.
Yeah.
It almost seems kind of comical. I would laugh going back to be a freshman now, taking a freshman history class when I used to teach it myself.
Well,
how surreal was that?
Well, there were some courses that were obviously new, like economics, right? That was good. But some others I just breezed through without a problem. I took chemistry 101.
Well, calculus too, right?
Calculus 1, 2, and 3. Yeah. Now, I had taught calculus at a much more advanced level in Germany than what 1, 2, and 3 delivered there. So, and I managed to complete the whole thing in 3 years and then, you know, ace the whole program, which was a bad mistake.
That was one of the funniest. I had to put the book down laughing. One of the funniest stories. So one thing, you got a 99 in your calculus class. How did you get a 99 and not 100? Did you, like...
Yeah, it sucked.
So, but the story of... You were too good of a student.
Yeah.
Because you ended up having the best GPA in your class, which meant what?
Well, and that was another cultural black mark, some ignorance there. I didn't know that you actually, when you have that high a GPA, you might wind up valedictorian, and it requires you to talk and get out in public. And
it's a story because you're not a 22-year-old college student. So the press may have picked up on the fact that...
Right. And why didn't they? Not even the college paper picked up on it.
Talk about luck.
Well, divine providence, maybe. But I don't know. But, yeah, you want to call it luck, and I call it. It was God's protective hand over me. It's like I was not yet to be found out.
Yeah. There's another great story there about you actually... As a English as a third language for you, a second language for you, ended up teaching a young Hong Kong student to learn English.
He's a very successful attorney in New York City now. He made Columbia Law Review, and I had some interaction with him on email. I forgot it is. I think the L is the Chinese people can't pronounce L, and he wrote me, "If it hadn't been for you, I would still pronounce certain words in a certain way." A very smart kid.
Well, you said for his Columbia Law School application, he wrote his essay about you.
About me.
About the nice American who helped him learn English.
Well, yes, and I used some of the same techniques that I used to, get to do phonetics exercises. I found a book and said, well, we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So once you graduated, you actually now had a legitimate quote-unquote American college degree, and that's when you got your job at MetLife.
Right.
As a solid and rewarding job, did this start to change? Is this where your perception of America began to change, or your ideological framework began to work? Because you actually talk about in the book that it used to be, at one point, the job was getting in the way of your intelligence work, but at some point it shifted to where your intelligence work was actually getting in the way of what you thought was a rewarding career.
Okay, so first of all, I like programming. For the first time, I could do something intellectually challenging on a daily basis. That was really I was home again with that in that regard. But what also happened was that so here I was now working for one of those evil insurance companies, and they were really nice to you. You know, my colleagues were great, and the company treated you well. We had free lunch. You could eat lunch, breakfast, and dinner there if you wanted.
So no free bread in Moscow, but you got free bread at MetLife in New York City. Okay.
it clearly disabused me of the notion of the evil Americans, and I you know, I was still looking for them. I couldn't find any, you know, other than this individual's rule.
Right.
But they happen everywhere. They happen to... So yeah, and the other thing that happens, IT jobs are pretty demanding. And I was on call. You know, I would get calls at night. And sometimes I had to work late and weekends. And I also had to do the spy stuff, and that was time-consuming. Mm. And I got really sometimes annoyed with doing the spy stuff because I had a real job.
Right.
So that's it wasn't a flip overnight, but it's a slow progression in right. that direction.
I want to talk a little bit about what the Soviets wanted you to actually collect for them. A lot of what they asked you to do was to look at science and technology intelligence, and this is during the Reagan period. This is during Star Wars. In the shows and in history and everything else, we read that Gorbachev and the Soviets were obsessed with Reagan and Star Wars. Did this come across? Did you get from Moscow Center this idea of we need to know what's happening for American science and technology?
Well, minor correction: the science and technology angle was brought to me only during my last visit after to Moscow after I was here for already 8 years.
Okay.
It was the first time that I was introduced to somebody from a different, I think, directorate or department. I don't know. That was science.
Mm-hmm.
The other folks I worked with were political intelligence.
Okay.
So this fellow we met, and he was quite honest. He said, you know, we're hurting. We need to catch up. So whatever technology you can find, you get your hands on, you know, send it our way. So I didn't find more than a set of computer programs. No idea whether they were ever used. I sort of doubt it because these were programs that help organizations run their business.
Right.
You have to have a structure that goes with the way this program wants
right.
to operate.
What would you say your biggest collection coup? Like, what was the most important piece of information that you were able to collect for the Soviets in your decade working for KGB?
Honestly, I can't tell because it may well be one, two, or three of the individuals that I described and fingered as a possible recruit, but they would never tell me.
Absolutely.
Not even a hint as to whether they even tried to recruit one of them. So, therefore, there's something open-ended.
Mm-hmm.
Probably in the archives of the KGB, you would find the answer. Other than that, personally, I didn't really
right.
manage to collect a lot of important information.
Well, there's an interesting... You have about a paragraph about this, about a mission they ask you to do, and that's actually the only one they allowed you to choose if you're going to do it or
yeah.
not. They go up
yeah.
to New Hampshire to look for a dead drop site.
Right.
You don't know exactly who it's for, but you have a pretty decent idea of who it might have been for. Can you talk a little bit about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, well, I think at the time there were Aldrich Ames and Robert Hansen were still embedded in the CIA and FBI, respectively. And I can only imagine it was one of the two because they were hot commodities and probably what they thought... they should avoid direct contact with resident agents. If somebody like me is in the middle, well, they wouldn't follow me. They didn't. The FBI had no reason to follow
right.
me, right? They would follow their agents, and typically, you know, they were pretty good at shaking their tails. I know that because you know every operation that required somebody to. I did several dead drop operations here, and every one of them worked,
mm-hmm.
with the exception of the very last one. But that means they were able to, you know, free themselves.
Right.
But anyway, the risk was probably still there, as opposed to me being in between.
Right.
And they never followed through. Interestingly enough, this was the only time where they asked me if I was willing to do that.
Mm.
And they didn't give me any more background, so why would I even say no?
Right.
You know, you have to go to New Hampshire, so no problem, find it. You know, pick up a suitcase, why not? But who would put the suitcase there? That was the reason why they asked me.
Right.
But, you know, they disclosed just very little. You know, I was mostly in the dark.
Let me ask you about 1985. Is in the United States, it's the year of the spy. This is when spies were being arrested left and right, and you were at that point, I guess, about 7 years into your time as an illegal for the KGB. Did that shake your confidence at all? Did you? Was that a year that we said, "Uh-oh, am I next?"
I can't remember.
Okay,
I have to tell you, this may well be something that my mind is blocking out. There's at least one other thing that I was surprised that I couldn't remember. It was absolutely something that you should remember, and then the FBI brought it to me and says, "We have it on record that you did this, this, and this." And I, for the life of me, I can't remember even today. I don't even know who did they catch in '87.
Well, 85 was John Walker.
Oh, Walker, yes. You know, I remember a little bit about this. No, that didn't bother me. Well. I was at that point, I was so sure that I was okay unless I did something risky, more risky than, say, graduating as valedictorian. Right. If I lived my life normally, I was sure that I'll be fine. And I didn't think about defectors and that kind of stuff.
Right.
You don't think about this.
Right? Yeah, no.
If it's useless. If you think about it, it serves no purpose. So you those thoughts, I didn't let enter my mind.
By the end of 1988, you actually got the emergency signal to leave from the KGB. What made them decide to pull you at that point?
Well, they didn't tell me specifically, and I still haven't found where they would have gotten that idea from, that my cover was about to be blown. But that's what I remember. They said, you know, you got to come home because you're in danger.
Mm-hmm.
Your cover is either blown already or it will be blown soon. And that I got in a encrypted radiogram, and in addition to that red dot that was the emergency sign. I really, once reading that dot, I was supposed to make a beeline for the place where I had hidden the emergency documents, and then go right into Canada from where I would be exfiltrated back behind the Iron Curtain.
And this wasn't like take your time and pack.
No.
This is, you're supposed to go straight there.
That was part of what we called the communication plan. That was the emergency procedure. And I had actually investigated, you know, how easy or hard it might be to cross into Canada. In those days, it was really easy. Mm-hmm. You walk across the bridge at Niagara Falls, right. And the Americans wouldn't even look at you. And I had probably forged Canadian documents, but I didn't do it.
What made you stay?
My daughter Chelsea, she's 29 now. She was a year and a half, and that was the first time in my entire life that I felt unconditional love for somebody else. When unconditional love, it means you can't do wrong, and I don't need anything back. I just love you. And so it's a very trite statement, but in this situation, it's appropriate. Love conquers all, you know.
Well, you had other kids at that point, but you'd never seen them grow up. You know, you didn't see it.
Oh, yeah, I had two. That's not true. I had two.
I mean, but you hadn't lived
with
them when they were growing up. This is the first time you had a child that you saw from birth growing up.
And that makes, for a man, that makes all the difference in the world. When you see your son once for 3 weeks, once every 2 years, and I met him, I saw him like when he was 1, 3, and 5. That was just, you know, he was also a sickly child at one, there was just no bonding going on. Whereas, you know, when every day you see this little thing that looks at you, and you know she's dependent on you, and she has the biggest eyes. I mean, serious. She has huge eyes, and she was a pretty, pretty girl, like doll-like pretty girl. And so then I fell in love with her.
You couldn't just say, "I'm not leaving. Screw you, KGB."
No.
But the plan you came up with was ingenious and a little disturbing at the same time. How did you get out of going back? What did you tell the Soviets?
Well, I wrote this Dear John letter in secret writing. Dear comrades, I understand that you want me to come back, but I have decided to stay back because I have contracted AIDS, and the United States is the only place where I might be able to get treatment. I then also described the chain through which I may have acquired this virus, because there was a girlfriend I had for a while whom I reported on, and so what I told them to make it more credible that she had a drug addicted boyfriend and had gotten the virus herself, and that's how I got it, and they bought it,
and they were terrified of AIDS at the point. This is like the perfect thing to tell them, man.
Wouldn't you? I mean, yeah. in those days, there was a lot of myth around the disease, how you could catch it.
Right.
And they were afraid to let AIDS into the country, for sure. I remember a conversation back at the center where one of the my handlers, indicated, well, you see, this is what they gotten into. It's a sign of the decay of capitalism, and
right.
we just got to make sure we don't let this in here.
Let me ask you about the end of the Cold War. You were in the United States when the Berlin Wall came down, when it collapsed.
Yes.
How did you feel watching, basically, at that point, your country dissolve
mm-hmm.
by 1990, certainly? And, of course, the next year, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the KGB.
Right.
Here in the United States, did you celebrate it like the rest of us did? Or was it, was it a bittersweet moment to where, because you already kind of come over to wanting to stay in the United States by that point.
I'm sitting in my living room in Ozone Park, and I'm watching TV. A room I still remember like it was yesterday, had a lavender carpet that I put in myself. And I'm looking at this, and I am emotionally detached.
Hmm.
It didn't have any meaning to me anymore. I didn't think it through. I had it didn't impact my life. I had decided to stay here. I would never go back to Germany. So therefore, and I didn't really do a whole lot of, investigating as to, the information that came out. I did later when the internet became a good research tool. I started, digging into East Germany's past, and what I found was pretty horrifying. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, it was even less of an event.
Right. So you thought you were free and clear.
Yeah, very much so.
You didn't know that the FBI had started to pay a little attention to you a little bit later in 1993.
Right.
What I thought was interesting was that they knew that you were working for the KGB at some point. But they had difficulty at first getting a warrant to put a listening device in to kind of check you out. And I think this
right.
certainly shows how little you were doing at this point. What did the judge say to the FBI when they asked for a warrant?
That also gives you an indication that the FISA court nowadays is in the news, how not easy it is to spy on Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently the judge was telling them, even though I wasn't an American, but they couldn't prove that I was a spy, which is like a catch-22, right? But the judge was ready to grant me the same rights as if I were an American. It was like really weird and frustrated the FBI no end.
Well, it was hard for the FBI to show that you'd done anything, right? Even if they knew you were a trained KGB
agent,
correct. There was no spying you had been doing. Yeah.
And all they had on me, I didn't know that, but that was disclosed to me much later. All they had on me was that I was in the country illegally, period. So they could have, I think that this at the maximum sentence for that was about 5 years,
mm-hmm.
not 30.
When did you know that they were on your trail? Did you have a hint, or was it just when the FBI showed up at your door?
I wasn't looking,
Yeah.
I have this back and forth with my friend Joe Riley, who was the lead agent. We played that out in front of an audience the other day. I told him that if I was still looking, I would have known. And he said, maybe not, because we were really cautious. Now, if you go through my apartment, I will know that you were there.
Mm-hmm.
There's some subtle signs.
The telltales.
Yes, that even the most thorough agents will miss. And, well, maybe the surveillance detection wouldn't have worked because Joe told me they stayed far back and, you know, any time. So, in other words, they had me at a distance, which means they, even if they had done something, they wouldn't have known.
Right.
Right?
It's like catch 22 there also is, yeah, you want to not be seen, but you want to be able to observe.
Right. Well, for instance, the brush bys, handovers, it takes only a few seconds in a dead zone. Right. I didn't at all pay attention to anything going on in my environment. And even when the new owners next door, which was actually FBI agents, I didn't pay attention to anything. I did my job. I played with my children. Blah blah blah. So I didn't know, to answer the question, I didn't know until they said hello. And that's another moment that I recall as if it were yesterday.
Well, I mean, that what Joe Riley said to you, that it doesn't have to be the worst day of your life. I mean, that seems an extraordinary way to approach somebody that you know has been an illegal spy in the side of the United States.
Yes. He left the door open because they wanted... He was out to get my full cooperation from the get-go, because he was convinced that I would. That was he came up to that conclusion because he observed me, and he knew that I loved my children, and so now he wanted to make sure that I knew that there was an avenue to get out of this somehow. But so that's why he opened the door a little bit. I wasn't sure for about 3 months that I wouldn't go to jail. That was a hint I might not go. But, you know, even if he hadn't said that, you know, that's from his perspective, even if he hadn't said that, at that point I knew that the only way to get out of this mess is to, you know, spill the beans. And I had no more reason to hold back anyway.
Let me ask you in the most broadest sense, because I know there's only, you can't say everything, but what did you provide the FBI? What did you let the... Why were they so happy to have you as a source?
Well, a lot of operational stuff. I had no names. Right? I couldn't give
right,
away.
Right, you're so detached and so compartmentalized.
Yes, right. even the last cipher I used, I was able to recreate for the NSA. That's a big one.
Mm-hmm.
And that came to me only in hindsight, the knowledge that there wasn't another mole in the government. That was important to know, too.
Were you using one-time pads, or were you using a cipher that you reused again and again?
For 8 years, I used the manual method.
Okay.
I used two of them. I was told they were good for about 200 uses, and the first one expired after 4 years, and I was taught another one, and after 8 years, there was just not enough time, so they gave me one-time pad.
And you were radioing messages, or were you leaving dead drops? I mean, getting a little wonky with some of the tradecraft stuff here.
Well, the communication path to the center was through secret writing. At first, I had two convenience addresses, so I could write two letters per month, and then I had only one that went to South America. They didn't have a second one, so I was limited to one a month. And when I had, there were occasions when I had too much information, so I would write it down, take pictures, and use a dead drop to to hand over the cartridge. The communication in my direction was all shortwave radio, exclusively, with the exception of science. But I never got anything in any meaningful communication other than shortwave.
I could ask you another hour's worth of questions, but I want to wrap it up with this. And I think this question may be something that listeners are thinking about. If one of your kids came up to you today and said, "Dad, I want to work for the CIA," What would your advice be? Would you be favorable to that? I know you, the visitors, the information, you are a U.S. citizen. You have a real U.S. passport in your name,
right.
Legitimate. You are as patriotic as the rest of us. What if one of your kids wanted to go into an intelligence work themselves?
You know, that question I was never asked. You know, there's another question that I...
you can't see me, but I'm doing the celebration dance. Yeah.
I was asked the question, you know, would you tell people, would you advise people that it's okay to go undercover? And that is a straight-out no without hesitation. But CIA work...
Or intelligence work at all. I mean, maybe they want to be an analyst at NRO or...
I would say it depends on the individual, and it depends upon what kind of work it might be. It could be just an analyst. You're sitting at your desk. That's all you do. But it's interesting and it's necessary. And unfortunately, this has been going on as long as I remember, since World War II, the intelligence community has gotten black eyes and been beaten up quite a bit and has occasionally misbehaved. I think we are doing our country a disservice to try to put a lot of obstacles in the way of folks who try to do their best to protect us. So I'd say, yeah, give it a try. But don't go undercover.
Yeah. We'd like to thank ZipRecruiter and Casper for their sponsorship of SpyCast. Remember, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/first, and you can get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting Casper.com/SpyCast and using the code SpyCast. Well, speaking of undercover, Jack Barsky is the author of Deep Undercover, My Secret Life and Tangled Allegiances as a KGB Spy in America. This book is available wherever great books are sold, including the Spy Museum retail shop. Jack, it's been a pleasure talking to you. We've been chatting several times over the phone, but it's nice to finally meet you in person. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining us on SpyCast. Every Tuesday, we'll give you the most interesting conversations with some of the most intriguing people in the world of intelligence. If you'd like to send us a comment or suggestion, you can email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Or tweet us at @intlspycast. That's intlspycast. The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming, please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.